with me. Shun was seething still, Fitzvigilant torn. I suspected he and Riddle had known each other well at Buckkeep Castle, and despite the differences in their positions, he had perhaps even regarded him as a friend. And now he must make a choice, and declare for the lady, or defend his friend. I wondered if his need to win my approval would weigh into this at all. I waited silently, knowing that how he decided would be how I judged him. He leaned on the table to look past at me at Lady Shun. "You should not judge the serving boy too harshly," he suggested. For a moment my heart warmed toward him. Then he ruined it by saying, "We are seated here among the commoners, and he is but a tavern lad in a backwater town. It would be a wonder if he had been schooled to the ability to recognize a high-born lady and grant her the priority that she deserves." How had Shade let him acquire such a high opinion of himself? While Shade had never debased me for the illegitimacy we shared, he had let me know that my birth to a common mother meant I could never assume that the privilege of the noble class would be accorded to me. I wondered if Fitzvigilant knew his mother had been a huntswoman, esteemed by the queen, but of no great standing at court. Did he imagine himself to be lost nobility of a very high order? Better than humble Tom Badgerlock, son of a commoner? Better than B? And in that moment, I knew with great clarity that Fitzvigilant was completely unsuitable to teach my daughter. How could I have ever believed otherwise? Once more I found myself shaking my head over my own stupidity. Fitzvigilant had failed as an assassin, so Shade had assumed he would do better as a scribe and teacher. And I had gone along with such a crooked piece of logic. Why? Did either of us believe that teaching children might be easier than killing them? What was wrong with me, that after so many years I still found myself willing to accept, unquestioningly, Shade's suggestions? I was an adult, surely, by now. But such was the power of my old mentor over me. I had long ago learned he was fallible, yet in unguarded moments I always fell back into the default that Shade knew better than I did. I seldom questioned his commands. Even worse, I seldom tried to pry out information he had not shared with me. Well, that would change now. I would know, without doubt, Lant's true parentage, and I would demand to know exactly why Shun was worth a dedicated effort to kill her. And I'd ask why on earth he had ever thought either of them could possibly function as a bodyguard or a tutor for my child. So I would be both to her, teacher and guardian. She could already read, and it seemed to me that most of my education had come from either reading or helping Shade in his odd experiments. There had been my physical training, of course, but I scarcely saw the need to teach B how to wield an axe or a sword. It made me smile to think of how earnestly she still pursued our evening lessons with her knife. A quick lesson in handling the blade had replaced a night story or song. She was quick, I had to give her that. After she had cut my knuckles twice, I had replaced her belt knife with a wooden blade. A few nights ago, she had startled me by evading my blade with a tumbling trick worthy of the fool himself. If I could teach her to dance to a blade, surely I could teach her all else she needed to know. I could manage a sufficient education for her, and what I did not know, I would have her taught by those who knew it best. We had an excellent healer in Withy. She could build on the foundation of herbal knowledge that Molly had given her. And yes, my daughter would learn to play an instrument, and to dance, and the thousand other things that were a woman's weapons in this world. And languages. The tongue of the Mountain Kingdom, certainly. And it came to me that there was little to anchor Bee and me at Withy Woods. We could spend a year in the mountains for her to learn their generous ways as well as their language. And the same for the Out Islands, and for each of the six duchies. I suddenly resolved that, before she was 16, my daughter would have travelled to all of them. It was as if I had been following a narrow trail, and had suddenly realized that at any time I could leave it and strike out cross-country. I could choose what and how she was taught, and in the process, shape who she became. For B had had the right of it. Girls did not have to hit to hurt. But did I want her to learn that sort of fighting from Shun's example, with Lance confirmation?
Your place to correct him, not mine or Lance. Does not it bother you that he has insulted me? And Lant? Are you listening? Hold a badgerlock!
When she uttered my name, I jolted back into the ongoing conversation. But I did not turn to her to respond, but to Fitzvigilant. My mind seized on an odd bit of information I needed. How many wax tablets were you hoping to purchase? Behind me, Shun made an exasperated sound at being ignored. It bothered me not at all. Fitzvigilant looked startled at the turn of conversation. He hedged suddenly, and I suspected he feared there would be a budget constriction. The merchant did not have many, of course. The double ones, I am sure, could be shared easily enough by sibling students and... We will buy what he has. I leaned back slightly from the table. I was watching the door of the inn for B to return. I worried suddenly about the quantity of chestnuts and sweets she had eaten. Was she all right? I'll reserve one for B's use. I'll be taking over her education. I do not find you fit to teach her. He stared at me, and it was a very young look. Humiliation and panic, dismay and shock vied to control his face. None of them triumphed, and so he simply stared. If it had not been B at stake, I might have felt sorry for having to do this to him. It took a few moments for him to find his tongue. He spoke very carefully and precisely.
If I have given offence somehow, or failed in your estimation, sir, I do...
You have, I cut in. I refused to feel any pity or remorse. Had he pitied B when he'd rebuked and humiliated her in front of the other children? His lower lip actually quivered. Then his face went stony. He sat up very straight.
When we return tonight, I will immediately pack my things and leave Withywoods.
His posturing wearied me. No. Much as you both annoy me, I cannot allow that. No matter how little I wish it, you must remain at Withywoods. I have seen that neither of you is ready to teach nor protect my child. How then do you imagine I find you ready to protect yourself? Fitzvigilant, you can continue to attempt to teach the other children, and I will be your instructor in both the axe and the sword, and in how to respect any man who can meet your eyes honestly. More of my time claimed, but at least it might eventually make him able to fend for himself. And Shun? I looked at her regal outrage. I will ask Steward Revel to see you instructed in whatever is most likely to win you a husband. I judge that not to be dancing or singing, but the management of a household within a budget. She stared at me coldly.
Lord Shade will hear of this.
Indeed he will, and from me, before your message reaches him. She narrowed her eyes to a cat's squint.
I will not return to Withywoods. I will, this very night, take a room here at Oaks Bywater and abide here alone. And to Lord Shade, you will answer for my leaving.
I sighed. Shun, it's nearly Winterfest. The inns are full. And you will return this evening to my home, where we will prepare to celebrate it for the sake of my little daughter. I will not hear from either of you any more threats of leaving. You will not, for I have given my word to someone I respect that I will watch over you. I looked from Lant to Shun. Her mouth actually dropped open. She shut it with a snap, and then abruptly demanded,
Badgerlock, how dare you assume any authority over me? Lord Shade put you at my disposal, for my convenience and protection. Send your message, however and whenever you will. I will see that he corrects any misconceptions you have about our positions.
And there it was, exposed in that single sentence. Despite Shade's careless dropping of my name, she had not put the pieces together. She was glaring at me as if she expected me to stumble back from her, bowing and apologizing. While she might be illegitimate, she was confident of her superiority to me. Lant, though a bastard, had been acknowledged by a noble father and was hence her equal. But not the serving boy, nor me, nor Riddle, because in her eyes I was as low-born as my daughter. Shun, that's enough. That was all I said. Her eyes narrowed and grew cold with fury. I almost wanted to laugh as she decided to exercise her authority.
"You are not permitted to speak to me like that," she warned me in a low voice.
I had almost thought of what I would reply when Riddle arrived at the table. He came bearing their dishes of food, cleverly balanced up one arm, and their mugs of cider in the other hand. With two thunks and a flourish, he set it all out before me. There was a glint in his eyes, his determination to put the events of the day behind him and be merry. Then his determined smile was suddenly replaced with a worried look and the question,
"Where's B?"
Alarm pierced me. I stood in the tight space between the bench and table. "She hasn't come back. It's been too long. I'll go find her."
"My cider's barely warm," I heard Shun exclaim
as I stepped over the bench and away. Chapter 29 Mist and Light.
Then, from the gleaming mists that surrounded us, there burst a wolf all black and silver. He was covered in scars, and death clung to him like water clings to a dog's coat after he has plunged through a river. My father was with him, and in him, and around him, and never had I realized him as he was. He bled from dozens of unhealable wounds, and yet at the core of him, life burned like molten gold in a furnace.
Dream Journal of B. Farseer.
It had all been ruined when the door of the tavern opened and banged shut again, and suddenly Shun and Fitzvigilant were there. The way Fitzvigilant looked at my father, I knew he had already heard the tale of what had happened in the town commons. I did not want him to speak of it to my father. We were past it now, and if he brought it up, Riddle would have to think about it again. Riddle and my father were behaving as if all were right now, but I knew that my father's actions would gnaw at Riddle's heart like a worm. My father was his friend, but he gave his ultimate loyalty to Nettle, and he dreaded telling her this story and revealing to her his part in it. But Shun, if she knew of it, made nothing of it, but only began to natter on about, "She must have this and she must have that, and if my father had coin, perhaps they could go and get it right now, or perhaps she would eat first." She sat down beside my father, and Fitzvigilant sat on the other side of Riddle, and they reminded me of red-mouthed fledglings squawking in a nest as they spoke of needing this and wanting that. My father turned away from me to speak to Shun. I couldn't stand it. I was suddenly too warm, and the press of the myriad conversations felt like hands over my ears. I tugged on Riddle's sleeve. "I need to go outside."
"What?
Oh, it's behind the inn. And come right back, you hear me?" He twisted away to reply to something Fitzvigilant had said to him. Odd how I must never interrupt, but my tutor saw no reason to observe the same courtesy to me.
"It's country food, Lant. Different from what you'd find in a Buckkeep town tavern, but not bad. Try the soup."
I had to wiggle to turn on the bench and then get down from it. I do not think my father had even noticed me leaving. On my way to the door, a large woman nearly stepped on me, but I darted round her. The door was so heavy, I had to wait until someone was coming in before I could slip out. The cooler air greeted me. It seemed as if the bustle of the street and merry atmosphere had increased as evening drew closer. I stepped just slightly away from the door so that I would not be hit if it opened, and then I had to move out of the way again because a man needed to unload a cart of firewood for the tavern next door. So I crossed the street and watched a man juggling three potatoes and an apple. He sang a merry little song as he juggled. When he was finished, I twisted to reach past my new market bag and dug deep into my new little pouch. In the bottom, I found my half copper. When I gave it to him, he smiled and gave me the apple to keep. It was definitely time for me to go back to the tavern and find my father, much as I dreaded being dragged about on Shun's errands now. But perhaps my father would send Riddle with her, or just give her money to waste. A wagon full of cider kegs with a team of 4 horses had stopped in the street, so I had to go around it. To get back to the tavern, I must walk past the grey beggar. I stopped to look at him. He was so empty. Not just his dirty pleading hand on his knee, but all of him. As if he were a plumskin, hanging on a tree after wasps had stolen all its sweet flesh and left only an empty shell. I looked at his empty hand, but I desperately wanted to keep my 2 coppers. So I said, "I've an apple. Would you like an apple, beggar?" He shifted his eyes toward me as if he could see me. They were terrible, dead and clouded. I did not want him to look at me with such eyes. "You are kind," he said, and I bravely stooped to set the apple in his hand. Just then, the door of the spice shop opened, and the thin little woman who owned it stepped out.
"You!" she exclaimed. "Are you still squatting here? Away! I told you, get away! A street full of customers, and my shop is empty because no one wants to step over your smelly bones and rags. Away! Or my husband comes with his stick to teach you how to dance."
"I go, I go," the beggar said softly. His grey hand had closed on the red apple. He tucked the fruit into the breast of his ragged tunic and began the slow struggle to rise. The woman was glaring at him. I stooped, found the staff he was groping for, and put it into his hand.
"You are kind,"
he said again. He gripped the stick tight, one hand above the other, and levered himself to his feet. He swayed and turned his face slowly from side to side.
"Is the street clear?"
he asked piteously.
"If I step out now, is the street clear?"
"Clear enough. Go now."
The spice woman spoke harshly as a team and wagon rounded the corner heading our way, and I resolved never to buy anything in her store.
"Don't step out," I warned him. "You'll be crushed. Wait, and I'll walk across with you." "Well, aren't you the interfering little snippet?"
She bent forward at the waist to mock me. Her heavy breasts lunged at me like chained dogs.
"Does your mother know you are running wild on the street and talking to dirty beggars?"
I wanted to say something clever to her, but she turned back into her shop calling,
"Henny, Henny, that beggar is still blocking our door. See him off as I asked you to do hours ago."
The rumbling wagon had passed. "Come with me now," I said. He smelled very bad. I didn't want to touch him, but I knew that my father would not have left him there at the mercy of the spice woman. It was time for me to begin behaving as my father's daughter. I took hold of his staff below his grip.
"I'll guide you," I told him.
"Step now. Come." It was a slow business. Even with both hands grasping his stick, he could barely stand. He took 2 little steps, hopped his stick forward, and took 2 more little steps. As I guided him out into the street and away from the door of the spice shop, I realized suddenly I did not know where to put him. There, he had been sheltered from the wind. To either side of us, the doors of the shops were busy with customers coming and going. Ahead of us was only the town commons. We hitched along slowly toward it. No one had returned to the place where the dog had died. Someone had taken her body away, and the bull's head, and as my father had asked, they had spread clean snow there, but the blood had soaked up through it. Pink snow, almost pretty, if one did not know what it was. I do not know why I guided him there, except that it was an open space. The canvas that had covered the bull's head was on the ground under the tree. Perhaps he could sit on that. I glanced back at the tavern door, knowing that if I did not return soon, my father or Riddle would come after me, perhaps both of them. Or perhaps neither. Shun was there, and she was fully capable of keeping both of them occupied to the point at which they would forget about me. A nasty feeling smothered my heart. Jealousy. I finally named it for what it was. I was jealous. It fueled my desire to help the blind beggar. I would not go back. They would have to come and find me, and when they did, they would see that I could be as brave and kind as my father, helping a beggar that no one else would touch. A man by a tinker's cart was staring at us in distaste. Plainly he wanted us to move farther away from him. I steeled my resolve and shifted my bag to settle firmly on my shoulder. "Give me your arm," I said boldly. "I can help you walk better." He hesitated, knowing how disgusting he was. Then his weariness won.
"You are too kind," he said,
almost sadly, and held out his stick of an arm. I took it. He lurched a little. I was shorter than he had expected. His dirty hand gripped my forearm. The world wheeled around us. The sky rainbowed. There had been a fog. But it had been a fog I had looked through all my life. Now it parted, as if a wind of joy had torn through it. I looked in awe at a beauty that tore my heart wide open. All of them, the scowling tinker, the holly-crowned girl kissing a boy behind a tree, the inn cat under the porch, the old man bartering for a new felted hat, all of them burst forth in glorious colours I had never imagined existed. Their flaws were overcome by the potential for beauty in each of them. I made a small sound, and the beggar sobbed aloud.
"I can see," he cried out. "My sight has come back to me. I can see. Oh, my light, my sun. Where have you come from? Where have you been?"
He gathered me to his breast and embraced me, and I was glad of it. The beauty and the possibility of glory that blossomed all around me flowed from him through me. This was how it was supposed to be done. Not in tiny glimpses. Not as unconnected dreams. Everywhere I looked, possibilities multiplied. It reminded me of the first time my father had lifted me to his shoulder, and I suddenly realized how much farther he could see from his height. But now I saw, not just from a better vantage, not just to a distance, but to all times. It was comforting to be held safe at the middle of that swirling vortex. I did not fear, as I allowed my sight to follow the myriad threads. One caught my attention. The kissing girl would marry that boy, crowned with orange blossoms, and bear him 9 children at a farm in a valley. Or not. She might dally with him for a time and marry another, but her memory of this moment would add sweetness to every pie she baked, and the love she had known would be shared with chickens and cats until she died, barren, at 72. But no, they would run away together this very night and lie together in the forest, and the next day, on the road to Buckkeep, they would both die. He of an arrow wound, and she would be raped and torn and cast aside to die in a ditch. And because of that, her older brothers would band together and become the Oaksby Guard. During the time of their patrols, they would take the lives of 52 highwaymen and save over 600 travellers from pain and death. The numbers were plain. It was suddenly so very simple. All I had to do was give them a tiny nudge. If I smiled at them as they strolled the village green and told them, "You shine with love. Love should not wait. Run away tonight," they would see me as a harbinger and take my advice. His pain would last but a moment, and hers only hours. Less time than she would spend struggling in childbirth for her first child. I had the power. I had the power and the choice. I could do so much good in the world. So much good. There were so many choices I could make for the good of the world. I would start with the holly-crowned girl. He clutched me tighter and spoke by my ear.
"Stop, stop. You must not. Not without great thought, and then... even then, there is so much danger, so much danger."
He turned my eyes, and the threads splintered into 1,000 more threads. It was not as simple as I had thought, for every thread I tried to follow became a multitude, and the moment I chose one thread from that multitude, it shattered again into yet more possibilities. She might say the wrong word to him, and he would murder her this afternoon. She told her father she had kissed him, and her father blessed them, or cursed them, or drove her from her home into the storm to die of cold in the night. Some are far more likely than others, but each has at least one chance to be real. So each path must be studied carefully before any path is chosen. The path you observed, where they both must die? If we were dedicated to this creation of the Oaksby God, we would look and look. There are always other time paths that lead to the same end. There will be some more destructive and ugly, and some less so.
I had thought he was speaking aloud to me. I became aware that his thoughts were seeping into me through the bond we shared. He poured knowledge from his mind to mine as if he were a pitcher and I the cup, or the thirsty garden that had only been waiting all this time for this nourishment.
And the paths change. They change constantly. Some vanish, impossible now, and others grow more likely. That is why the training takes so many years, so many years. One studies and one pays attention to the dreams. Because the dreams are like guideposts for the most significant moments. The most significant moments.
He took his attention from me, and it was as if someone had torn a warm cloak from me in the midst of an ice storm. He stared with his blind eyes, terror and joy stamped on his scarred face.
"The wolf comes," he recited. "His teeth are a knife, and the flying drops of blood are his tears."
Then my vision faded to the same sort of sight one has in deep twilight before the last light of the day fades. The colors were muted, and shadows prevailed, hiding all detail from me. I thought I would die. Every possibility was hidden, masked and limited to a single instant of time. I felt I could not move. Life was stiff and limited and slow. Time had been a limitless ocean, spreading out in every direction, and I had been a seabird, free to wheel and flit from one moment to a thousand other possibilities. Now I was mired in a tiny puddle, struggling to experience even 1 second fully, blinded to the future consequences of any action I might take. I stopped and stood and let life happen around me.
Chapter 30. Collision. My wolf taught me as much as I ever taught him. But strive as he might, he never completely succeeded in teaching me to exist in the now as he did. When we spent quiet snowy nights sprawled on the hearth before a comfortable fire, the wolf had no need of conversation or a scroll to read. He simply enjoyed the comfort of warmth and resting. When I would rise to pace the small room, or pull a burnt stick from the embers to scratch idly on the hearthstones, or take up paper and pen, he would lift his head, sigh, and then put it back down and resume his enjoyment of the evening. When we hunted together, I would move nearly as silently as he did, watching, always watching for the flick of an ear or the shift of a hoof. That tiny motion that would betray a deer standing poised in the brush, waiting for us to pass by. I would flatter myself that I was completely in the now, tuned exclusively to the hunt. And so intent would I be on that watch that I would startle when, with a pounce and a shake, night eyes would kill a crouched rabbit or huddled grouse that I had walked right past. I always envied him that. He was open to all the information that the world offered him. A scent, a sound, a tiny movement, or just the brush of life against his wit sense. I never achieved his ability to open himself to everything, to be aware of all that was happening, all at once. Unsigned journal entry. I hadn't taken more than a step before Riddle was up and beside me. He caught at my arm. His mouth was a flat line as I turned to him. He spoke quietly, almost without inflection, as if he himself had no idea how to feel about his words. "I need to say this before we go fetch B. Fitz, it isn't working. In fact, it's exactly what Nettle feared. You're a good man, and my friend. I hope you can remember that I'm your friend as I say this. You're not a good... You aren't able to be a good father. I have to take her back to Buckheap with me. I promised Nettle that I would see how things were going for both of you. She didn't trust herself to decide. She was afraid she'd be too critical. I pushed down my sudden flare of anger. Riddle, not now, and not here. Later I'd think about his words and what they meant. I shrugged free of his hand on my arm. I need to find Bea. She's been gone too long. He caught at my sleeve and I had to turn back to him.
Exactly. But until I pointed it out, you hadn't noticed that. The second time today she's been put into danger.
Shun had a fox's ears. She was eavesdropping. Behind us, she made a small sound between disgust and amusement, and spoke for me to hear.
And he says you are not fit to teach his daughter,
she observed to Fitzvigilant snidely. I nearly turned to her, but the wolf in my heart leapt to the forefront.
Find the cub. Nothing else matters.
Riddle had also heard her. He dropped his grip on my sleeve and started toward the door. I was two steps behind him. All manner of thoughts raced through my mind. Oaks Bywater was not a large town, but all sorts of folk would be converging on it for Winterfest. All sorts of people bent on having a good time. And for some of them, a good time could involve hurting my little girl. I barked my hip on a table's edge, and two men shouted as their beer leapt over the rims of their mugs. Then Shun was stupid enough to seize my sleeve. She had come after me, and Lant trailed her.
Riddle can find B. Hold her, Badgerlock. We need to settle this once and for all.
I ripped my sleeve from her grip so abruptly that she cried out and clutched her hand to her chest.
Did he hurt you?
Fitzvigilant exclaimed in horror. Riddle had reached the door and was waiting for two very large patrons to come in before he could go out. He leaned to look around them. Then,
No! Stop! Put her down!
Riddle roared the words as he slammed through the two men trying to come into the tavern and out the door. I lunged away from Shun and crossed the crowded tavern in a stumbling run. The door stood wide open and I bolted through it. I gazed wildly around the busy commons.
Where had Riddle gone? What had he seen?
Folk were treading calmly through the snow. A dog sat scratching itself, and the driver of the emptied wagon in front of the inn chirruped to his team. Past the wagon, I caught a glimpse of Riddle, running through startled idlers toward a ragged beggar who had lifted my small daughter in his crooked, dirty hands and held her tight to his breast. His mouth was by her ear. Trapped against him, she was not struggling. Instead, she was very, very still, her feet dangling, her face looking up into his, her lax hands open and held wide, as if begging something from the sky. I passed Riddle, and somehow my knife was in my hands. I heard a sound, a roaring like a beast, and a roaring in my ears. Then my arm was around the beggar's throat, pulling his face away from my daughter's, and as I bent his head back with the crook of my elbow, I plunged my knife into his side, once, twice, three times at least. He screamed as he let go of her, and I dragged him back with me, away from my child in her red and grey shawl, fallen like a torn rose in the snow. Riddle was there in an instant, wise enough to snatch my daughter from the snowy ground and fall back with her. His right arm held her to his heart, while his left had his own knife at the ready. He looked all around, seeking some other foe or target. Then he glanced down at her, took two steps back and shouted,
She's fine, Tom. A bit stunned, but fine. No blood.
Only then did I become aware of people shouting. Some were fleeing the violence, others converged in a circle around us as eager as crows at a killing. I still held the beggar in my arms. I looked down into the face of the man I had killed. His eyes were open, greyed over and blind. Row of scars lined his face in lovingly inflicted lines. His mouth was crooked. The hand that clutched still at my strangling arm was a bird's claw of crookedly healed fingers.
Fitz, he said quietly, you've killed me, but I understand. I deserve it. I deserved worse.
His breath was foul and his eyes like dirty windows. But his voice had not changed. The world rocked under my feet. I stumbled back and sat down hard in the snow. The fool in my arms. I realized where I was, under the oak, in the bloody snow where the dog had bled. Now the fool bled. I felt the warm blood from his wounds soaking my thighs. I dropped my knife and pressed my hand to the punctures I had made.
Fool!
I croaked. But I had no breath to make words. He moved one hand, blindly groping, asking with infinite hope,
Where did he go?
I'm right here, right here. And I'm sorry.
Oh, fool, don't die.
Not in my arms. I could not live with that. Don't die, fool. Not at my hands.
He was here. My son.
No, only me. Just me, beloved. Don't die. Please don't die.
Did I dream?
Tears spilled slowly from his blind eyes. They were thick and yellow. The breath of his whisper was foul.
Can I die into that dream? Please?
No, don't die, not by my hand, not in my arms, I begged. I was curled forward over him, nearly as blind as he was as I fought the blackness at the edges of my vision. This was too terrible to live through. How could this be? How could this be? My body longed for unconsciousness, and my mind knew I had but a knife's edge of a chance. I could not survive this if he did not. He spoke again, and blood was on his tongue and lips as he formed the words.
Dying in your arms is still dying.
He breathed two breaths.
And I cannot, must not.
The blood crested his lips and began to trickle over his chin.
Much as I've wished to, if you will, if you can. Keep me alive, Fitz. Whatever the cost to us, to you, please. I need to live.
A skill healing, even in the best of circumstances, is a difficult thing. It's usually accomplished by a circle of skill users, a coterie, who are familiar with one another and are capable of loaning one another strength. The knowledge of how a man's body is put together is essential to it, for in severe instances, one must decide what injuries are most deadly and deal with those first. Ideally, before the healing is attempted, all will have been done to accomplish an ordinary healing, wounds cleansed and bound, with a patient who is rested and well fed. Ideally. I knelt in the snow, the fool in my lap, surrounded by chattering onlookers, while Riddle held my terrified daughter in his arms. I lifted my eyes to Riddle and spoke clearly. I've made a terrible mistake. I've hurt an old friend who meant my child no harm. Care for B and keep these others back. I wish to say a prayer to Ida. It was a believable excuse, and there were enough followers of Ida present that they could persuade the others to give me quiet and space. No one had shouted for the city guard. It was entirely possible that few realized I'd actually stabbed the beggar. Riddle's astonished gaze reproached me, but for a wonder, he obeyed, and I suddenly knew just how deep our friendship actually went. He called out loudly for people to give me space, and then, turning, I saw him shout and beckon Fitzvigilant to his side. Shun was following the scribe, walking like a cat in wet snow. I saw him speaking earnestly to both of them, taking command, and knew he would handle it all. I closed my eyes and bent my head as if in prayer. I plunged into the fool's body. We no longer had a skill link. For an instant, his boundaries opposed me. I summoned skill strength I scarcely knew I possessed and breached his defenses. He made a low sound of objection or pain. I ignored it. This was a body I knew intimately, having once worn it. It was like and unlike a man's, with differences that were both subtle and crucial. To close the wounds I had caused and stem that bleeding was not a complicated feat, and I made it my first task. Undo the damage I had done to him. It took focus, and my willing his body to make that healing a priority worth burning his scanty reserves. So I stopped his bleeding and felt him dwindle and weaken as his body accelerated that healing. For while the skill is a powerful magic, it does not do the healing. The body does, under the skill's direction, and there is always a cost to the body's reserves. Almost immediately, I saw my mistake. I moved through his body with his blood, finding old damage and bad repairs and places where his body had trapped poisons and sealed them off in a vain effort to control their spread. One of my knife plunges had pierced such a toxic pocket, and now it leaked blackness into his blood, and his pumping heart was carrying the poison all through his body. The wrongness was spreading. I felt his body's weary physical alarm, and then a peculiar resignation began to spread through him. It was not his mind, but his body that knew his life was at an end. A strange pleasure began to spread through him, a final comforting that the flesh offered the mind. It was soon to be over. Why spend your last moments in alarm? Almost that lure of peace drew me in.
"Fool, please,"
I quietly begged him to rally. I opened my own eyes to look into his face. For a long moment, the world spun around us. I could not focus. The healing had taken more from me than I had realized at the moment. I drew a shuddering breath and widened my eyes. It had never been easy to meet his eyes when they were colorless. Even as they had acquired tint and moved from a pale yellow to gold, it had been hard to read what was behind that gaze. Now his eyes were occluded, grayed in what I suspected had been a deliberate blinding. I could not see into his heart any more than he could see out of them. I had only his voice to go by. It was breathy and full of resignation.
"Well, a bit longer we shall have to gather. But at the last, we fail, my catalyst. None have tried harder than we did."
His tongue, bloodied still, moved over his chapped and peeling lips. He took breath and smiled with scarlet teeth.
"Nor paid a higher price for that failure. Enjoy what good is left in your life, old friend. Evil times will soon be upon you. It was good to be near you. A last time."
"You can't die. Not like this." A thin smile curved his lips.
"Can't die. No, Fitzy. I can't live. Would that I could. But I can't."
His eyelids, as dark as if they had been bruised, closed uselessly over his clouded eyes. I lifted my gaze. Time had passed. How much, I could not tell, but the light had changed. Some of the village folk had fallen back into a wandering circle, but as many had decided there was little to see, the beginnings of Winterfest beckoned, and they had gone on their ways. Riddle still stood there, a dazed bee in his arms, flanked by Shun and Fitzvigilant. Shun huddled shivering in her wraps, her face a mask of righteous anger. Fitzvigilant seemed completely confused. I looked directly at Riddle and spoke heedless of who might hear or wonder. "I must take him to Buckkeep Castle. Till the skill coterie for healing, through the pillars, will you help me?" Riddle looked down at Bee in his arms and then back at me. "She's fine," he said, and I heard his rebuke that I had not even asked about that. But surely if she were not, he would have told me that instantly. I felt a twinge of anger at him that faded immediately. I didn't have the right to be angry at him, nor the time to be anything but desperate. I stared at him. He shook his head, denying me, but said, "I'll help you however I can. As always, I have." I gathered my feet under me and stood with little effort. The fool weighed nothing. Nothing at all. He had always been slight and limber, but now he was skeletal and bound with scars and rags. The Gorkhas were staring at me intensely. I could not afford to care about that. I advanced toward Riddle. He stood his ground, but both Shun and Fitzvigilant retreated from what they thought was the body of a smelly old beggar. I darted my eyes at Fitzvigilant. Get our team and wagon. Bring it here. Shun began with,
But what about the green?
I just looked at her, and she closed her lips. Go, I reminded Fitzvigilant, and he went. When he was two steps away, Shun decided to go with him. Good. Bee, look at me, please. She had had her face buried in Riddle's neck. Now she slowly lifted it and stared at me. Blue eyes of ice in a pale face. The red in her shawl was a shocking contrast. Bee, this man didn't mean to frighten you. I told you about him once, remember? He's an old friend of mine. Someone I have not seen in many years. Riddle knew him as Lord Golden. I knew him as the Fool, when we were children together. One thing I am certain of, he would never, ever hurt a child. I know you were frightened, but he meant you no harm.
I wasn't frightened, she said softly. Not until you killed him.
He's not dead, Bee. I hoped I sounded comforting. But he is hurt, and badly. I need to take him to Buckkeep Castle right away. I think he can be healed there. I heard the creak and rumble of the wagon, and the remaining Gorkhas made way for it. There were going to be some strange stories told that night in the tavern. No help for that. I carried the Fool to the tail of the wagon. Shun was already ensconced in the corner of the bed closest to the seat. Bring some of those robes and make a pallet for him. She stared at me, unmoving. Fitzvigilant set the brake, wrapped the reins, turned, and stepped over the back of the seat into the bed of the wagon. He gathered an armful of the unused wraps and tossed them toward me. Riddle had come to stand beside me. He set Bee down in the wagon bed, wrapped her warmly, and then arranged the other blankets. I set the Fool down as carefully as I could. He made a gasping sound. We're taking you to get help. Just keep breathing. I left my hand on his chest as I spoke, reaching for him, trying to hold his life in his body. As always, I could not sense him with my wit, and the skill bond he had put on me was something he had taken back decades ago. But there was something there still, something that linked us, and I tried desperately to feed strength to him. I clambered awkwardly into the wagon bed, never breaking my touch on him. With my free hand, I reached out and pulled Bee toward me so that she leaned against me. Riddle, you drive. The stones on Gallows Hill. I know them, he said briefly. He walked away, a thousand conversations in his silence. He clambered up to the seat, and Fitzvigilant conceded it to him, climbing into the back of the wagon to sit with Shun. They were both regarding me as if I had loaded a rabid dog into the wagon with them. I didn't care. The wagon started with a lurch. I didn't look back at the people who stared after us. I closed my eyes and reached out for Nettle. There was no time for subtlety.
I have Lord Golden. He is grievously injured, and I will need the help of the coterie to keep him alive. I am bringing him to Buckkeep Castle through the Judgment Stone. Riddle says he will try to help me.
A long silence. Had she not sensed me? Then she responded.
Are you skill-linked to Lord Golden, then? We were once, and I have to try this, no matter how foolish. Not foolish. Dangerous. How can you bring someone through a pillar if he has no skill or link to you? You'll be risking Riddle as well as yourself. I have a bond with him, Nettle. I don't understand it completely. I was able to reach into him and heal him. I think I have a strong enough connection to be able to bring him through a pillar. Riddle has no skill, but he is able to travel with you or Shade. I would not ask this if his life were not at stake, so please, summon the others and have them ready. Today, tonight? But there is an important dinner this evening, with delegates from Bington, Jamalia, and Kelsingra. It is to celebrate the approach of Winterfest, but also to negotiate new trading terms and... Nettle, I don't want this. I need this. Please.
There was a pause that lasted an eternity. Then she said,
I will gather as many skilled ones as can help with the healing then. Thank you. Thank you. I am in your debt. We're coming now. Meet us at the witness stones. Send a wagon or sled. What about B? Who will look after her?
Who would look after her? A downward lurch in my heart. I would have to depend on the two people I had just proclaimed unsuitable to be near her. Two people who were insulted, offended, and in Shun's case, without the morality to realize none of that was B's fault. I knew less of Fitzvigilant. Shade seemed to set great store by him, as did Riddle. And Nettle. I'd have to give their judgment more weight than my own, and hope he was a big enough man not to take out his grudge against me on my child.
Fitzvigilant will take her back to Withywoods. Don't worry, it will be all right. Please!
Oh, how I hoped it would be all right. Fence that thought well with a tight skill wall.
Send a cart and team to meet us at the witness stones,
I repeated.
Tell them my life depends on it.
An exaggeration, but not much of one. Shade at least would understand, and dutiful. I pulled my mind free of hers and put up my walls. I didn't want a skill right now. I wanted no distractions at all from keeping the fool alive. I looked down at B and felt disloyal. This was supposed to have been our day together. Well, it had been doomed from the start. She leaned on me, and I moved her shawl, tucking it more closely around her. We hadn't bought half the things I'd intended to get for her. When I got back, I'd make it up to her. I'd make a raid on the markets at Buckkeep Town and bring her an armful of pretty things to make up for it. The fool and I would return together, and it would be a winter fest to remember for all of us. The fool groaned again, and I turned to him. I leaned down and spoke softly. We're going through skill pillars, fool. I'm taking you to Buckkeep Castle for the coterie to heal. But it will be easier for me to take you through if we are skill-linked, so... I took his hand in mine. Years ago, in the course of tending King Verity, the fool had accidentally brushed his fingers against Verity's skill-laden hands. The silver skill had burned and soaked into his fingertips. His touch on my wrist had once left marks, silvery fingerprints, and a link between us. He had taken them back, right before I had made my fateful trip through the skill pillars and back to Buckkeep. I intended to renew that link now, press his fingers to my wrist once more, and gain, I planned, enough of a skill link to take him through the standing stones with Riddle and me. But when I turned his hand to look at his fingers, horror and sickness rose in me. Where once silver had outlined the delicate whorls of his fingertips, gnarled scar tissue now deadened the ends of his fingers. His nails remained as thick and yellowed nubs, but the soft pads of his fingers were gone, replaced with coarse, dead flesh. Who did all this to you, and why? Where have you been, fool? And how could you let this happen to yourself? And then, the ultimate question that had haunted me for years and now sounded louder than ever in my heart. Why didn't you send for me? Send me a message, reach out somehow. I would have come, no matter what. I would have come. I scarcely expected an answer. He might not be losing blood, but the poisons I had released into his body were spreading. I'd stolen strength from him to seal the cuts I'd made. Whatever reserves he had left, he had best marshal against the poisons within. But he stirred slightly, and then spoke.
Those who had loved me tried to destroy me.
He moved his blind eyes as if he tried to look into mine.
And you succeeded where they had failed. But I understand, Fitz. I understand. I deserved it.
He fell silent. His words made no sense to me. I did not mean to hurt you. I would never hurt you. I mistook you. I thought you meant her harm. Fool, I am sorry. So sorry. But who tormented you? Who broke you? I pondered what little I knew. The school that raised you. They did this to you? I watched the slight rise and fall of his chest and rebuked myself for asking him a question. You don't have to answer. Not now. Wait until we've healed you. If we could. My hand was on his ragged shirt. I felt ribs beneath it, ribs knotted with old breaks badly healed. How could he be alive? How could he have come so far, blind and alone and crippled? Seeking his son? I should have tried much, much harder to find the boy, if the fool's need for him was so great. If only I'd known, had some inkling of how desperate a state he was in. I'd failed him. For now. But I'd help him. I would.
Shame.
The single word rode an exhaled breath. I bowed my head, thinking he'd read my thoughts and rebuked me. He spoke again, very softly.
Why I didn't call on you for help. At first, ashamed, too shamed to ask for help. After all I did to you, how often I plunged you into pain.
His grey tongue tried to moisten his peeling lips. I opened my mouth to speak, but he tightened his grip on my hand. He was gathering strength. I kept silent.
How often did I watch the trap close around you? Did it truly have to be so awful for you? Did I try hard enough to find another path through time? Or did I just use you?
He ran out of breath. I was silent. He'd used me. He'd admitted it to me more than once. Could he have changed the path of my life? I knew that often enough, a word or two from him had made me reconsider my actions. I remembered well how he had cautioned me about Galen, and even suggested that I turn aside from my skill training. What if I had? There would never have been that beating that near blinded me and left me with years of pounding headaches. But when would I have learned the skill? Did he know such things? Did he know where every untaken path in my life would have led? He gave a little gasp.
When my turn for torture came, for pain, how could I call for you to save me from it when I had not rescued you or turned you aside from it?
That speech was shattered by a series of coughs as feeble as if a bird choked. I lifted my hand from his chest. I could not bear to feel how he struggled to get his breath.
You
never need to feel that way, fool. Never. I never saw it that way. On an indrawn gasp,
I did. In the end.
Another gasp.
When I learned for myself what I'd asked of you, how a minute of designed pain becomes an eternity.
He coughed again. I bent my face close to his and spoke very softly.
It was long ago,
and it's far too late for you to apologize, for any forgiveness was given years ago. Not that I thought there was something I needed to forgive. Now stop talking. Conserve your strength. You'll need it for our journey. Did he have enough stamina to survive a trip through the skill pillar? Could I take him through, unlinked to me by the skill? But I had been able to reach into his body. Surely that meant something. That there was still some tie between us. Useless to wonder. I knew he would not survive unless I got him to Buckkeep that night. And so I would take the chance. We'd go through the pillars together. And if... B spoke on my other side. Her voice was little more than a whisper.
You're going away?
For a little while. To take my friend to a healer. What if I didn't come back? What if neither of us survived? What would happen to her then? I couldn't think about that, and I couldn't not think about it. I still knew I must try. I felt no compunction at risking my life for the fool. But her future? I lifted my voice slightly. Shun and Fitz Vigilant will take you back to Withy Woods and look after you until I come home. Her silence was eloquent. I took her little hand in mine and said quietly, I promise I will come back as soon as ever I can. Liar. Liar, liar. A promise I had no right to make when I did not know if I would survive the trip. It would be very useful for Lady Shun and me to know exactly what is going on. Who is this beggar? Why did you attack him? Where are we going now? And why are you leaving B in our care with absolutely no warning or preparation? Fitzvigilant didn't try to suppress the edge of anger in his voice. I supposed he had a right to his annoyance. I tried to temper my reply with patience, not to provoke him to any greater anger than he was already feeling. I had to leave my daughter in his care, at his mercy. It took me a moment to sort what I would share. He's an old friend. I mistook his actions, didn't recognize him, and attacked him. He needs healing, far more healing than we can do at Withy Woods. I'm sure you've heard of the magic of the skill. We intend to use the skill to travel through a stone pillar to Buckkeep Castle. There, my old friend can get the healing he needs. I must go with him. I hope I will not be gone more than a day or two. Neither of them said anything. I chewed my pride and swallowed it. I would have to ask this of him at least. I looked at my bee. For her, I would do anything. I spoke more softly. In the tavern, I told you that I doubted your abilities, not only to teach, but to protect my child. Fate has given you a chance to prove me wrong. Do this, and do it well, and I will reconsider my opinion of you. I expect you to step up and assume the responsibility I'm giving you. Watch over my child. I hoped he would find the meaning in my words that I dare not say aloud. Guard her with your life. Shan spoke abruptly, with the confidence born of supreme ignorance.
The skill magic only belongs to the royal Farseer line. How can you possibly use... Be silent!
Riddle spoke the command in a tone I'd never heard him use. I doubt that Shan had ever had anyone speak to her so. But for a miracle, she did as she was told. With a wriggle like a nesting hen, she settled back in the robes next to Fitzvigilant. I watched them exchange a look of shared outrage at how they were being treated. The team plodded on. The snow on the road was deepening, clinging to the wheels. For a moment, I sensed how the horses strained, smelled their sweat in the cold air. I restrained my wit and cleared my throat. I squeezed my daughter's hand softly. B is a capable child. I trust that you will recognize that she needs very little supervision in her daily tasks. Her lessons will go on, as I assume they will for all the children of the estate. In my absence, let her set her own routine. If she requires help from either of you, I am sure she will seek you out. If she does not, then you need not be concerned for her. She has Careful and Revel in addition to you. Will you be comfortable with that, Bee? My little daughter gave me a rare, direct look.
Yes. Thank you, Papa, for trusting me to mind myself. I will do my best to be responsible.
Her mouth was set in a solemn line. She squeezed my hand in response. We were both putting a brave face on the situation. I know you will. Nearly there, Riddle called back to me. Will they be ready? Yes. I hoped Nettle had taken my message seriously. No, I knew she would. I had not bothered to mask my emotions. She would have sensed my desperation. They would be waiting for us. Again I saw Lady Shun and Fitzvigilant exchange a look of mutual offense at being excluded from our cryptic exchange. I cared not at all. The track up to Gallows Hill was not well tended. The wagon jounced and slid in the ruts and I gritted my teeth at the pain it must cause the fool. As soon as the horses halted, I was out of the wagon. I staggered sideways, the world spun, and then I found my balance. I leaned on the wagon and pointed up at Fitzvigilant. Take B home. And I'm counting on you that she will be safe and content in my absence. Are we clear? Even as he nodded, I knew this was not the best way to handle the man, let alone Shun. They would both be resentful and confused. It could not be helped. There was no time to do better. I took B's hands in mine. With her sitting on the open tail of the wagon, we were nearly on a level. She looked up at me, her fair skin whiter in contrast with the grey and red shawl that now covered most of her golden hair. I spoke softly, only to her. Listen to me. Mind Fitz Vigilant, and if you have any needs, make them known to him, or Lady Shun, or Revel. I am sorry, so sorry, that our day was disrupted. When I return, I promise that we will have a whole day all to ourselves, and that things will come out well. Can you trust me for that? Her gaze was now tranquil and accepting, almost lethargic.
I think I will go first to Steward Revel. He knows me well, and I know that you will try your best to keep your promise, she said softly. I see that.
I'm glad that you do. I kissed her on top of her head. Be brave, I whispered. Riddle was clambering down from the wagon seat.
Where are you going?
Shun demanded of him. I'm going with Fitz, he told her. Through the stone and back to Buckkeep. We are trusting Lady Nettle's small sister into your care. I more felt than saw how he turned his eyes on Fitzvigilant. I was staring at my child, wondering how I could risk this and how I could not. Lant, we've known each other a long time. I know the man you are capable of being. Never have I trusted you with more than I am entrusting you with now. Watch over B with kindness. Nettle and I will hold you responsible for her well-being. He spoke softly, but there were teeth in his words. If Fitzvigilant replied, I did not hear it. I let go of B and turned to the fool. It was as if I saw him for the first time. If not for our moment of violent intimacy, if he had not spoken as I plunged the knife into him, I never would have known him. Only his voice had identified him to me. The rags he wore were beyond dirty. They stank and dangled in hanks of rotting fabric. From his knees down, they hung in wet brown tatters. His long, narrow feet were bound in rags. All his grace and elegance were gone. The scarred skin of his face was drawn tight over his bones. He was staring sightlessly up at the overcast sky, still and resigned to whatever might befall him now. I'm going to pick you up, I warned him. He made the slightest nod. I tucked one of the blankets around him as if I were bundling a child. I slid my arms under him and lifted. The motion released a fresh waft of stench. I held him carefully and looked at Riddle. How do we do this? He was already moving toward the stone. He glanced at me over his shoulder. If you don't know, how do you suppose that I do? His grin was both resigned and scared. He'd do this. He'd risk his life at my request. He'd lend me his strength to attempt something that might kill all of us. I didn't deserve such a friend. Carrying the fool, I followed him up the snowy track toward the standing stone. I glanced back once at the wagon. No one had moved. The driver's seat was empty. All three were watching us climb the last bit of rocky hill to the judgment stone. I pitched my voice lower. How did you and Shade do it when he brought you through the stones with him? He took my arm. I thought of Nettle. When he stepped into the stone, I followed. I could feel him drawing on me. It was like, well, like someone chilled cuddling up to you in a bed, taking your warmth. And then we stepped out. It was a lot less difficult than walking him down this hill in that snowstorm and finding our way to the inn. That was where he really needed my strength, not passing through the stones. He tipped his head to indicate the fool. That's really Lord Golden?
Yes. He looked at him dubiously.
How can you tell?
I know.
He let it be, but then asked, How will you take him through the stone? Are you linked to him?
I was, long ago. I hope it will still be enough. I shook my head. I have to try.
Riddle's steps had slowed. So much of you I don't know, even after all the years, even after all Nettle has told me.
The snow had stopped, and the light was fading from the day.
We could all get lost, couldn't we? You and I. We've never tried this before. And you're hoping to bring him through with us. All three of us could...
We could all get lost. I had to finish the statement for him, admitting what we both knew. The enormity of what I had asked him settled on me. It was too much. I had no right. My friend. But I now knew beyond any wondering that he was far more than a friend to Nettle. Had I the right to gamble his life? No. Riddle, you don't have to do this. I can try it on my own. You could take Bee back to Withywoods and watch over her for me. I'll send a bird as soon as we're safely at Buckkeep Castle. Riddle folded his arms over his chest and hugged himself as if he were cold, or holding his fears in tight. His dark eyes met mine directly. No pretense. No indecision. No. I'm going with you. I saw your face back there. I saw how you staggered when you got off the wagon. I think you've spent most of your strength in trying to heal him. You need strength. I've got it. Nettle said I could easily have been a king's man if I'd wanted.
You chose a queen instead, I said quietly, and he smiled, agreeing without a word.
We found ourselves facing the standing stone. I looked up at the glyph that would take us to the witness stones, not far from Buckkeep Castle. I felt the terror rise in me. I stood, holding the fool's body to my chest, feeling the fear and the dragging weariness. Had I already spent the strength I would need for this? I looked down at his ravaged face. He was still, and slowly that same stillness filled me. I looked back once over my shoulder at Bee. She watched me, motionlessly. I nodded to her. She lifted her little hand in a vague wave of farewell. As if he knew my thoughts, Riddle grasped my arm. I took a long moment to be aware of him. My old friend. Better than I deserved, these friends. I moved my thoughts like a weaver's shuttle, from the fool to Riddle, to myself and over again. I recalled our friendships, the terrible places we had been, and how we had survived them. Are you ready? I asked him. I'm with you, he said, and I could feel that was true. It was as Shade had described it, a sort of harness to which I could cling. Rather like holding to a powerful horse while crossing a deep, cold river. I clutched the fool to my chest, and we stepped forward into stony darkness. Chapter 31 A Time of Healing.
The duties of a king's man are simple. He must first maintain himself in excellent health of body. This will assure that when the king calls upon him to lend strength, he will have it. The king's man must have a close affinity to the one he serves. It is best if he has a true regard for the one who will draw skill strength from him, rather than simple respect and a sense of duty. This regard should ideally extend in both directions. The skill user who calls upon a